grown men are playing at soldiers in fields, taking it too far till somebody bleeds. I blame the squire, 'cause he's off his head. He won't be happy till everyone's dead. And deep in the church, in a really dark place, something awakens with a very big face. What must it be like to live in a wall? Just a big head with nobody at all. As battle continues, the village is sacked. The demon just lurks in a wall that is cracked. Roundheads act cavalier, playing their games. And here comes a teacher, played by Polly James. And deep in the church, in a really dark place, malice awakens a big scary face. What must it be like to live in a wall? Just a big head with nobody at all.
Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi everybody. Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations put out by Target Books from 1973 onward in publication order. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. This week, Book 95, The Awakening, the last Season 21 novelization, at least the Peter Davison Season 21, from the original Target run. There is one non-Peter Davison story in Season 21. The book of that is coming out shortly, and we'll get to that in turn. But for this week's episode, our guest is Andrew Smith. Andrew was on the show a few weeks ago for a conversation during a bonus episode, but now he's back to talk about the TV episode and the novelization. He has some very interesting points to raise, and we have a spirited discussion about The Awakening and, of course, several other topics, both inside and out of the world of Doctor Who. I am going to challenge Andrew to a game, but he is going to challenge me to a game. We will see how we both do. My thanks, as always, to Jim Sangster for the opening song for this week's episode, and, of course, for introducing Andrew to this podcast in the first place. We have some news. We finally have air dates for the first three Russell T. Davies episodes. The first three will be starring, of course, David Tennant and Catherine Tate, and those are going to be called The Star Beast, Wild Blue Yonder, and The Giggle. We knew those names already, but this is the first time that we have air dates, November 25th, and the following two Saturdays after that. In the States, those will be airing on Disney Plus, which will mean that we can actually watch Doctor Who without commercial interruption, dropping on Disney for streaming reportedly at the same time as the episodes air in the UK. It'll be nice to watch the show unedited and without commercial interruption, the way it was meant to be seen. Very much looking forward to that. There's also been some publicity material and artwork surrounding the release of the three new episodes, and we have an email from longtime friend of the show, Kevin Hush. Kevin Hush writes, three stories on three successive Saturdays with a mini break, then the Christmas episode with Shooty. So I was looking at the posters, and I realized where I had seen them before. The Star Beast mimics a cover of the first issue of Marvel Comics' Doctor Who comic book series back in 1980. I believe that is the U.S. version of the comic. Of course, those would have been released in DWM in the U.K. Back to the email. The poster for Wild Blue Yonder mimics a Doctor Who New Adventures by Virgin, of which Russell T. Davies wrote for. And the cover for The Giggle mimics the Target covers for The Celestial Toymaker and The Nightmare Fair. Back to that again. Thus, the posters cover the history of the show not seen on television. What an interesting concept. Kevin, from Columbus. Thanks again, Kevin. Meanwhile, we have a very good interview with Andrew Smith coming up after the break, followed by my breakdown of the Awakening novelization itself. I will preface this by saying I am a very big fan of The Awakening. It was one of my very first stories. It's a story I watch every few years. There's never been a time that I've watched The Awakening and have not enjoyed it. Andrew is going to be coming at The Awakening from a slightly different perspective. I love having a different guest on this show every week, giving me perspectives that I have not thought about or considered before. So, the conversation with Andrew Smith, and then my review of the novelization. Let's get to it.
Hi, I'm Rupert Booth.
I am known as Paul Ferry.
And my name is Barry Williams.
Together, we host Time Ram.
Time Ram's a cruel mistress.
It's a random number generator.
That also.
We roll a number from 1 to 13, and that's our doctor. Then 1 to 300 for the story, and then we ram them together.
Even if it doesn't make sense.
Cruel, I tell you.
Time Ram. Putting the wrong doctors in the wrong stories, so you don't have to.
You're listening to Doctor Who Literature.
Very happy to welcome back to Doctor Who Literature the author of Full Circle and many, many Big Finish audios, Andrew Smith.
Hello, Jason. It's lovely to be back.
Once you reached out to me about the show, I knew that I wanted to get you on talking about a story that was not your own, because I would love to know what Doctor Who writers think about other eras of the show, with which they may not have been directly involved. So the story that we're covering today is The Awakening from 3 years after season 18.
Yeah.
Same opening credits, different doctor, different script editor, different cast.
Yeah, it's an odd one. I mean, if you're getting a writer of Doctor Who to talk about something written by another Doctor Who writer, it's something that I come at it from the point of view of I can kind of see the building blocks and things, and this is a story that it kind of was in my peripheral vision in a way, that it's two episodes, it went past very quickly back in the day because it was in 1 week. It was I forget what days of the week it would have been, but in a week both episodes would have gone by. And it wasn't one. It was one I when I came back to it, I'd only watched it a couple of times, and I remember quite liking it, but not really understanding it. and actually, I'd sum it up now as saying I think it's one you can get a lot of enjoyment out of watching it. I think as a novel, it's really interesting, because as you know, I had not read this one before, and having read it, I don't think there's any novel. I haven't read them all, but I had read them all before, about 2 years before this. With this one, I doubt there is any Doctor Who novel that is as true to what's on the screen as this one is.
I will put my cards on the table for you.
Yeah.
This was one of the first stories that I watched as a fan, because I came in basically beginning middle of season 20. So right. By the time The Awakening rolls around, I'd already seen Enlightenment. I'd already become a complete hopeless fanboy of the show. And yeah. The Awakening was not my first two-part story. I would have seen King's Demons first. At that point, I thought everything was a four-parter. But the setting, the quasi-historical nature, the monster behind the church wall, the digital monster that pukes in the TARDIS console room, to an 11-year-old boy, what's more exciting than a puking monster?
So this was a story that checked all of my very early fandom boxes, and it's kind of unique among the novelizations. It's the only novelization of a two-part story that does not add any additional invented material to pad out the length of the book. So you've got a book that goes through page 144, but unlike, say, King's Demon, which has a different ending, or Edge of Destruction, which adds all this new material about the TARDIS, this is the one two-parter that doesn't give us any new scenes or any new sequences or any new storylines. It is a very long book, considering that it's only covering maybe 40 to 60 pages of script.
Yeah, and I think it's a good read. I mean, the prose, I think it's very good. The narrative, the actual content, again, there's some contradictory stuff in there and some things that we'll talk about, I'm sure, but that's just odd. But I think it's as a TV program and as a book, I think it's an enjoyable read. I think it's an enjoyable watch. It's something, the more you analyze it, and I've come at it now for the first time looking at it analytically, you think, no, hang on. and it does show, because the background to it, and Eric Pringle was not well served in this, because he'd storylined a four-part serial, delivered scripts, I think, for 2-3 episodes, and then was told, no, make it 2 episodes. Then he wrote episodes, and then Eric, the other Eric Sayward, came in and did a rewrite, particularly rewrote episode 2. but there are things, and I'm not just a writer, but a Big Finish, I'm a script editor, and I can kind of see some things here where things I think have been a little bit rushed, I would say, and some details have been, and some things have been introduced that I think lead to the things that when you look at it analytically, you think, hang on, that doesn't make sense, or why are they saying these things when they couldn't know these things? And it's all a bit rushed at the end, as people comment on the DVD commentary. But I do think it's a strong idea. It's a strong concept. It looks really good. And I think it is something that as a TV program and as a book, you can come to it fresh. You can watch it and think, oh, I really enjoyed that. As a book, you can read it and think, I really enjoyed that. I do think, though, when you can revisit it, as we do, and both in this age of where we can revisit things, but also as Doctor Who fans, as we do, pick things apart, you see, well, actually, you know, there's that sort of, and I see this as a writer of Full Circle, where people could analyze that and say, well, hang on. You know, that history, the 40 generations or something of the Starliner, that is, you know. So I'm throwing stones in a greenhouse here, but anyway.
It is very easy after 40 years hindsight to find the plot holes and say, ah, Eric Sayward should have done this. But again, as you point out, he was essentially writing the two-part version of this from scratch, and it isn't like he had 3 years to craft this as the story that he'd been waiting his whole life to tell. He's got a day job. And it's not as bad as it would be in season 22, where I think he had to write 3 scripts entirely himself 100% because the original submissions were either no good or late. So he's not doing as much heavy lifting as Eric Sayward does in season 22. But again, this is a sort of short notice draft, and it's only 2 weeks, so it doesn't have the ability to spin out subplots and misdirections and surprises. It's a very compressed story structure. And we know this now because we wouldn't have had all these Andrew Pixley-style details in 1984 when the story comes out. It's easy to go back and say, but why didn't he do X, Y, and Z? And perhaps if I had not had this as one of my very first stories, I would have been more inclined to find plot holes. But for me, it's also the tone of the story and the fact that we have, you know, the fact that you have 7 or 8 people in the TARDIS crew at the end and everyone gets along, that's an unusual thing for the Eric Sayward era. So the optimism of it appealed to me when I was young, not only the historical aspect and the monsters. So this is a story in tone that I happen to enjoy quite a bit more than
yeah.
the more nihilistic and gruesome tone that is coming the following year under season 22, which is Eric Sayward Unleashed.
Yeah, it's such a nice the tone of it is really nice. It's funny. I mean, I've got quite a few pages of notes because I've approached this kind of like I would if somebody said to me do a sequel to The Awakening, and I'd looked at it and I'd have done what I've done here, which is, you know, done a few pages of notes. Writing a sequel to this would be odd because I don't even know what the malice is. This is one of the things that, because I've analyzed this now quite a bit. I looked at it, and you know, the doctor when Will first says to him the malice, the malice, I saw the malice, you know, the malice brings war, and the doctor's first words are the malice is a superstition. And then subsequently he's saying, oh no, the malice is this, the malice is a living being. Of course he hasn't seen the face come out the wall at that point, so you could say, well, he sees the face come out the wall, then he realizes what it is. And he uses the term at one point, the thing you call the malice. So maybe the doctor recognizes it as something else, but he never says that. He never says, oh, actually, it's this. I know what this is. He comes up at various points. He comes out with pieces of information where you think, well, hang on, where have you got that information from? It's a living being manufactured as a weapon that was brought to clear the way for an invasion. As he says, basically at the end of the story, it's like, well, okay, Doctor, where did you get that information from? It has not been explained. When he's in the passage with Jane Hamden, he finds this little bit of squidgy metal and later says, you know, we found the remains of the probe ship. And it's like, well, no, you haven't. You've found a bit of metal. There is no remains of a ship or whatever. And then there are so many points where there's information coming out where no one has actually discovered that information. The doctor hasn't learned it. So where does it come from? And is that a result of things being cut down, or is it a result of just too much being tried to cram into a two-part story that was initially planned as a four-part story? And the nice thing here, again, the info text on the DVD supplied by the very lovely Paul Skoons.
Great.
I've been in the last week. I've just been listening to the Caves of Androzani episode that he contributed to. It's fascinating. And he's so, so good. And fandom is lucky to have him. Again, you know, help recover the Lion episode of The Crusade. But clearly, just what I've heard, just a lovely guy. God, I lost my thread now. I forgot what I was going to say.
So getting back to your point about, is this a compression of a four-part story? Had it been a four-parter, we would have had twice the number of sets. We may have had some more supporting characters. We probably would have had a lot more of these revelations about the malice and its history delivered along the way as plot twists, or maybe as one of the missing two cliffhangers. So, as you say, we're not given a lot of context for how this thing got to Little Hodgkin in 1643. Perhaps if it were done today, we would be able to actually see footage taking place in 1643 and see Will Chandler in two different time zones. There's certainly room for a lot more bouncing back and forth between the timelines and seeing you know, the original George Hutchinson or seeing the malice on both sides of the time rift. No, we just don't have that. And unfortunately, the novelization doesn't put it in. So all we can do is speculate.
But I remember why I was mentioning Paul in the info text, actually, because he mentions in the text that, I haven't seen this anywhere else, but he says that Eric Pringle's original idea was that the Malice was actually a servant of the devil. And Eric introduced the idea, the sci-fi idea, that he was actually an alien. And that is a major change. That is a very major change. And maybe what we've got is, a clash of those two ideas. But actually, that central idea of like an entity that feeds off of the energy and the anger and the malice, M-A-L-I-C-E, generated by conflict and war, and turning that around as an energy to use destructively, is a really good one. It's really, really good. It's just unfortunate that the two episode thing, and maybe turning the idea around from being a true horror concept of a servant, an actual servant of the devil, taking people over, corrupting a village, whatever, is not something that was something we wanted in Doctor Who at the time, or Eric Sayward and JNC wanted in Doctor Who at the time.
So in 1971, we had already seen The Demons, which mm-hmm. also takes place in a small village with evil brewing in a church.
Mm.
And that is a sci-fi version of literally a demonic character with the same name as one of the fallen angels from Paradise Lost. But there's this sci-fi overlay in a spaceship. And then a year or two after that, you have The Wicker Man, the movie with Christopher Lee, which seems to inspire this episode in terms of the grisly fate of the Queen of the May. What would have happened to Tegan?
Yeah, I mean, that's an odd thing. I mean, watching it again, and I remember first time around, the May Queen is quite an established thing here. And we had a thing called, when I lived in Glasgow, I lived in a place called Rutherglen, which is a royal borough, and we had a Lanimer Day, we'd have a Lanimer Queen, which is a kind of a Queen of the May kind of thing as well. But it was always a celebration. This thing of burning the Queen of the May at the stake was something I found quite alien. And I was looking into it again ahead of speaking to you tonight. And it's something remotely mentioned as like a pagan ritual or whatever. But the May Queen is, as I know, as I think most people here know, is more of a celebratory thing, and it's not something that ends with the May Queen being burnt at the stake.
So either he's getting his idea entirely from the Wicker Man, or he envisioned the Malice completely corrupting the May Day ceremony. And the May Queen for that year happens to be destroyed because of the Malice's malign influence. Again, we don't know for sure, but those to me seem the most likely choices.
Yeah. And it's odd again, because, I mean, there is this thing of you don't quite understand what's going on with a Malice, the influence that it has on people. This is one of the issues with the story I've got, is I don't know who's affected by the Malice and who isn't, and who's just going along with things. And one thing that the novel does rather clarify, I'd wonder, you know, is everyone in the village affected by the Malice? Are they turned around? And the troopers, I mean, Sir George Hutchinson, Dennis Little's character, is going around saying, kill them, capture them, bring them here, they're my prisoners, and the troopers are going along with it. And if you're just Civil War actors reenacting things, why would you go along with that? And I wondered again, with the May Queen coming in, did the villagers actually go along with her being burnt? There's a sequence in the novel where it's talked about the towards the end, when Sir George is coming apart at the seams, that Eric Pringle, because there are two Erics here, so you got just to specify, Eric Pringle says they are dismayed at Sir George's behaviour and where this is going, and they wander off. But it, again, it just runs, well, what is the malice actually doing? Is it, who is it affecting? Who does it affect? Who doesn't it affect? It seems to affect Willow, possibly, or is he just a weak individual going along with Sir George? Doesn't seem to affect Ben, doesn't seem to affect Jane. If it doesn't affect the soldiers, why are they going along with orders to take prisoners? And it's odd.
My impression, and again, this is, of course, subject to disagreement, my impression is that the way for the malice to corrupt you is to start behaving in the way the malice desires. And the more you get into the reenactments, the more you get into the violence, the more the malice takes hold. Mm. There's a reference from the Glenn Houston character that Sir George started off playing the reenactment honorably, but the more it progressed, the crazier he got. And certainly there's a difference between his performance in the earliest scenes, where he still has this mask of geniality, towards the end, when he is a complete frothing, raving lunatic. And one thing I wish had happened is that there would have been a way to save Sir George at the end. He's really the only named character who's a fatality. And it's not really his fault that he was possessed by the malice. His death seems a little harsh. That's something I would fix with 39 years hindsight. But Willow definitely seems to be sadistic. But again, my impression is that the more he got into the games, the more the malice influenced him. And once he switches sides at the end, that influence fades away and he becomes a rather nicer human being. Someone like Ben Woolsey, who was kind of distant from it, someone like the Polly James character, who wasn't taking part at all, or Tegan's grandfather, they were not influenced in the slightest because they weren't generating these negative impulses in their brains.
Yeah, we need to come back to Tegan's grandfather, actually. Because Verney, as a character, but the thing, there is a line about, you know, is Sir George's deranged mind gave the malice a way in. And it's, that's odd, because the suggestion is that he was deranged beforehand. But this is the thing, and even right, okay, with Tegan's grandfather, let's address that. He's entirely, as it is on TV, frankly, it's kind of, he's entirely pointless. He's there as someone, you know, Tegan's visiting. Turlough bumps it, happens to meet him when he's locked up in the same place. And then they have a conversation about the malice that Turlough engages with. Even though Turlough has not heard of the malice before, Verney starts talking to Turlough about the malice, and Turlough is, oh yeah, okay. It's like he's seen the previous scenes with Will, but Turlough left. Turlough has not heard about the malice before. But there's so much going on. There's so much contradiction going on. And people knowing things that they shouldn't know, not least of all the Doctor, who just keeps dropping things into the conversation about a ship that we haven't seen. And he talks about the remains of a Hackle probe at one point. Well, he hasn't seen any remains of a ship. He's seen a bit of squidgy metal. Again, it's all part of the thing that just looks like something that's just been, and I can relate to, I know how difficult it is when you're editing something particularly and you have to rework it right at the end. And I've been there working overnight to kind of rewrite things. But you have to keep your eye on the ball, really.
Well, I was a big fan of The Awakening, but I think you're kind of talking me out of it.
I think my overall view is, again, I think if you watch it without analyzing it, it's lovely. But then you just wait, hang on a minute, and just look at the detail, and there are just so many things. You think, hang on, and I did on a. I watched it for this, and then I rewatched it, and I was taking notes, and I just kept thinking, hang on, how does he know that? How does a doctor know that? How does and there are a couple of scenes where characters are coming out with things they cannot possibly know because they haven't been present when the information has been delivered. And the greatest example of that is when Turlough meets Verney. And Verney is saying, you've been to the church. And Turlough, yeah. Oh, and the malice. And he starts talking to malice. And Turlough, oh, yeah, yeah. But Turlough and Tegan left the church. They met Will, but they left the church before Will said to the doctor, I seen the malice. Hello, pussycat.
Smudge has decided that she's been standing back for far too long. Yeah. She wants to get her 2 cents in.
I have no problem. And that, you know, that sort of thing kind of takes you out of it a little bit. And but Verney, I scripted it as well, and I was thinking to myself as I watched this that if I was presented with a storyline for this two-part serial, which Eric Sayward was not, because it was presented as a four-parter, first of all, I'd have looked at the storyline for this, and there's an issue with Andrew Verney, Tegan's grandfather, that he doesn't really do anything. And there's another issue, which I think it would really help if the malice could communicate so we could actually understand what it's about. So why doesn't it properly possess an individual? And the first suggestion of that is George Hutchinson. But even better, why not Verney? Now, he doesn't really do much at the moment. So my note and a storyline on this would be, why not have a little twist that he makes out he's a prisoner, but actually he's a personification of the malice. He's been fully possessed. And he can voice what the malice is. And then when they're in the crypt, he can turn around and speak with the voice of the malice and say, this is what I'm about. Boom. And then give his presence in the storyline some purpose. Because at the moment, there isn't really one other than he. And again, there are gaps. There seem to be very significant things have happened off screen that we don't know about. Things have happened before the TARDIS crew get there. So Verney talks about, he's investigated the malice, but what has he found out? How has he found out what the malice is about? He says he very vague in the way he talks to Turlough about it, and he's told George Hutchinson what he's found. But there's some very significant things we don't get any detail about. But when Verney has found the malice, it hasn't activated, it hasn't awoken. So what has he found? Has he been behind the wall? And he seems to have told Sir George how the malice operates, certainly in the detail in the novel. I don't know if that detail is there. I don't think it's there in the TV series. So then it all gets a little bit, just very confusing. And that's why, again, 3 days ago, I sent you a little video clip, didn't I? Which is Woolsey. Can you explain to me what's going on? Because I just don't understand anymore. the more you look at it, it just needs an explanation, because we still don't know what the malice is, what it really is, what it's about, what it's actually trying to do. And the doctor gives us this dump of info at the end that it's a being, but it's engineered as a weapon. well, exactly how and how does it work? And it seems to be psychic, telepathic, but we don't actually get anything explained.
Something I'll say in defense of the Andrew Verney character, Keegan has been put through the most intense psychological horror in what is now her fourth season on the show. And it's an article of faith that if we meet anybody that is close to Tegan, that person is going to suffer a horrible fate. So Auntie Vanessa killed off Tegan's very first week on the show. Then in season 20, we meet her favorite cousin. And then her favorite cousin is possessed by Omega and is turned into a drooling, bug-eyed slave. And we're told that he's all right, but we never see him recovered. So there's no happy conclusion with him seeing Tegan off and saying, I'm better now. So the fact that Andrew Verney is locked up but is not harmed in any way and gets to spend the last scene in the TARDIS, leading possibly to a big finished box set of Tegan and Andrew Verney adventures in between The Awakening and Frontios, at least it's a happy ending for one of Tegan's relatives, and that is unique in the classic series.
I'll tell you, in my head canon, there is a very odd line from Turla when he's testing the door where they're locked up together. And he says, it's something like, have you got any experience as a, are you any good as a battering ram? And I do have in my head canon that he just picks Verney up and slams his head into the door. Because it's the most bizarre line. Have you got any experience as a battering ram? And it's, what? And I just, he picks him up and just slams into the door. And don't get me, again, they're locked up, there's no guard. Yeah, there are bars in the window, but a very rickety door. And can I just tell you from my police experience as well? It's a common trope in TV. In real life, do not try to force a door with your shoulder. it will lead to injury. Kick it by the lock. There you go.
I have been binge watching the 1960s American gothic / sci-fi soap opera Dark Shadows. Ran for 5 years, 1,225 episodes, made the household name of vampires. One of my friends was literally named after a character on Dark Shadows because her mom had been a huge fan growing up in the 60s. So I've been watching two episodes a night, same way that I did with Doctor Who during the pandemic, when I went through the entirety of the classic series in 13 months. So after almost 4 months of watching Dark Shadows two a night, I am now up through episode 238. Just the other night, this innocent female character, a cocktail waitress who has been possessed by the show's, at this point, new vampire, who later becomes the main character of the show, but at this point, he's still an antagonist. He is possessing Maggie the same way that Dracula possesses Lucy in the original novel. So Maggie is behind a locked door, and Barnabas is on the other side of the door, presumably feeding off of her. So one of the show's male heroes decides to batter the door down with his shoulder. And as he was trying to do that with this prop door, I had the exact same thought that you're just giving us as advice. Do not try to open a door with your shoulder.
Kick.
But whoever was syncing the sound effect with the soundtrack did a very poor job. So this actor stage rams the door. There's no noise at all. Then as he backs up for his second try, then you hear the collision. Then he tries again, and the sound syncs up. Then he tries a third time, and there's no sound at all, and the door flies open. So, yeah, I would not recommend you try that at home either.
No. It's fraught. I've seen it. Sorry, I've seen it in real life, and it leads to injury. But
that is perhaps a TV trope rather than the fault of Eric Sayward himself.
Yeah. So the Verney character, I think, just needs more justification for why he's there. But I come back to the thing. I think it is a story if you just watch it and don't analyze it too much. It's good. I think it's got a really good vibe, a really good tone. It's really well made. I think the director, first time director, that he does a fantastic job. It just looks really good. And Barry Newbury, the designer, on his last ever Doctor Who, having worked on the very first one,
And that, a 21-year legacy.
Wow. Yes. Yeah. That church set is incredible. Absolutely incredible.
And the location footage is always a plus on Doctor Who, but The Awakening has a very lush travelogue feel to it. Especially for me at age 11, I had not been to England yet, so I would never have seen a village like that with my own eyes. Seeing it on TV was quite appealing.
I've been to quite a few like that, and I know Dorset and Hampshire and that quite well. I don't think I've been to these particular places, but they are of a type. And I've spent quite a bit of time the last couple of years down in Dorset. It photographs really well, and it looks really good. And it's the sort of thing the BBC does really well is too, especially when you get the costumes involved and everything. And it's a lovely idea. Again, people dressed as Cavaliers and Roundheads in the modern day, what was then the modern day. Very, very good. Yeah.
There is a tradition in the U.S. of reenacting our Civil War, which took place a couple of centuries later. But you have people who, as an avocation and as a hobby, will reenact as Confederate or Union Civil War soldiers from the 1860s. So
yeah.
I could easily see The Awakening being retold for an American audience with the American Civil War. The Twilight Zone revisited the Civil War quite a bit because it's this big stain on the American psyche. So for me to learn about the English Civil War, and I learned about the English Civil War for the first time from this episode. So again, that was another
big,
helpful cultural cross-pollination for me as an 11-year-old from the U.S. who'd never set foot outside of North America at that point.
It's a huge part of the history of this country because the toppling of Charles I led to true parliamentary democracy. And we went through all the Cromwell years of austerity and then Charles II came to the throne in 1660, and we went through the pain of the Civil War, the Cromwell years, restoration of a monarch, and the model being established from that point of like the Parliament has primacy, the monarch is the head of state. It was huge. It was absolutely huge. Yeah.
So let's take a step back from The Awakening for a moment before we get to the book. As we approach the run-up to the 60th anniversary, you and I speak, it's only one day ago that we learned when the first of the RTD 60th anniversary specials are going to air.
Yeah.
I've been asking all my guests, and I'm a little hesitant to ask you this because it's putting you on the spot, but I've been asking everybody what is their favorite Doctor Who TV story from the last 60 years. And so far, every single person has given me a classic series. Most people have given me a Tom Baker story. And it's very easy to imagine that you're going to give a particular Tom Baker story yourself as your favorite of all time. But if you're willing to play this game, I'd like to know what is your favorite story. It doesn't have to be yours.
I'm tempted to do 20 questions now. Actually, I'm very tempted. Okay. Should we do that?
You want to do 20 questions?
Should I do 20 questions on my favorite story? I think you might get there fairly quickly, but go on.
All right. So this is a first. I have played 20 questions on this show before.
With a guest host. I heard that episode.
That's right. And I did reasonably well, but I did not come close to setting records. But there I had time to prepare. Now it is being sprung on me. But I am playing 20 questions in order to guess Andrew's favorite story of all time. So I will start off. And I'm not going to go for the easy Hail Mary. I'm not going to try and get it in one question.
Oh, I don't know. This might be one where you could do it.
It feels like that would be unfair. Besides, David Barsky has already played that card.
Go on, then.
Question one. Is it a 21st century Doctor Who story?
No, it is not.
Ah, so that brings us back to the classic series. Is it a black and white Doctor Who story?
No, it is not.
Okay. So that takes us... I've managed to eliminate 40 years of Doctor Who with two questions, and there I have us down now between 1970 and 1989. Is it a 1970s story?
Yes, it is.
Ah, which eliminates what would have been my trying to guess it in one question.
Oh, wow.
So, if it's a 1970s story, is it from the Philip Hinchcliffe era?
It sure is.
Ah, all right. So now we have three seasons to guess from. If I get it in, if I guess once, then I get it in five, which I think ties me for the record. So I'll go for the Hail Mary on this one. Is it the Ark in Space?
The Ark in Space? No, it is not the Ark in Space.
All right, so now we're down to 15 Philip Hinchcliffe stories, and I have 15 questions remaining. But in order to save time, I'll be a little more efficient. Is it a story from season... Is it a story that was aired as part of season 12?
No.
Is it a story that was aired as part of season 13?
No.
So that brings us to season 14. Is it, which would make you twinsies with David Barsky, is it the Talons of Wang Chiang?
It sure is.
Ah, so now Talons has come up twice on this show as an all-time favorite. That's great.
No, it is. And I understand people have the issues with it, but that was, I mean, that Robots of Death into Talons of Wang Chiang was 10 weeks of Doctor Who bliss, frankly. And it's when I first communicated with Robert Holmes as well. Sent a script in just after. And asked him, I remember I asked him why it was that Lee Shen Chang gripped the Doctor's boot, gripped the Doctor's shoe when he died. And it's because he was saying the House of the Dragon was, he came back to me and said it's because the House of the Dragon was in Boot Lane in London. But yeah, I totally understand people's issues with that story. But I just got back to how I reacted to it at the time, and I just say it's just an excellent story. Mm-hmm.
Every time I watch it, I can't help but love the dialogue and the acting and the production. And I do have the story in my top 60, which is a special episode I will air next month. But I did have to penalize it in my top 60 for all the stuff that we know now about some of the more insensitive elements of the script. But
yeah.
While it is not my number one, it is still in my top 60. I'll be talking more about it next month. That's two votes.
Well done. I'm sorry. I did spring that on you. I sprung that on myself, actually.
I was going to guess the Dominators as my number one, but I didn't want to give Fraser the satisfaction.
Ah, right. No, you know I love the Dominators. We talked about it before, but I do. I absolutely love it. I was seven years old. And
I was surprised by your answer, but I really enjoyed your explanation.
Lovely.
So now I'm going to challenge you to a game. So now that we've established your favorite, we're
going to
play... And this is the game that you heard me play with Paul Scoons on the Andrew Zani episode.
Yeah.
This is a new game that I'm workshopping, and this is Guess the Quote. With Paul, I was picking quotes that I enjoy, which are not the all-time favorite, all-time classic, preserved in quote books or shown over again on clip shows. I was giving him quotes that I like. And
Paul, I didn't get them either.
I'm going to make it a little bit easier for you. And for two of the three, I've gone to the episode generator website, and it gives me a random classic Doctor Who episode and story part.
Right.
And I go to the transcript of that and pick out the most interesting or most famous quote from that particular week of the show. And then the third one is a quote that I have mentioned on this show several times in the past, and I'm curious to see if you can identify it. So the very first quote. And I'm not going to try to do the accent or the voice effect, but I'll do as best as I can. Take them to the security kitchen.
The Sensorites. No, it's the Ark, isn't it?
Yes.
It's the Ark.
You were on the right track, but sorry, on the wrong spaceship. All right.
Oh, what? My God. Take away my fine credentials. That's, okay, right. Okay.
I'm gonna give you the point for that one because
no. Well, a half at most. A half at most. I no. Take them. Yeah. Okay.
Leading to Toby Haydock getting a security kitchen plaque for his kitchen, which we see on many of the Blu-ray collection DVD documentaries. Quote number two: "Don't move. The tree won't hurt you."
Oh. Well, I'm gonna say Mark of the Rani.
And how did you deduce that?
Because Perry gets turned into a tree. I can't. I don't.
You are correct, by the way. It is Mark of the Rani.
It is.
I went to episodegenerator.com/doctor-who-old, and it gave me the Ark part 3, and it gave me Mark of the Rani part 2. And those are two fairly infamous quotes in fandom, so I thought they were.
Well, Mark of the Rani is, I mean, that season is the one I did not see on broadcast. And if I have the books of Attack of the Cybermen, Time Lash, Mark of the Rani, because I didn't see them on broadcast because it was my first year in the police service. I was in the police section house, and I didn't see those episodes. So yeah, I'm quite pleased I've gotten that one.
We're coming up with the novelizations of season 22 because we've already covered the last Peter Davison story. And yeah. This is, of course, the last of the Peter Davison season 21 novelizations until the 21st century when Eric Sayward comes back to novelize Resurrection of the Daleks. So the Colin Baker story from season 21 and all of season 22 are coming up very, very soon on the show. But I have not discussed my feelings about season 22 yet, and we haven't talked about any of the episodes at length. But among fans of a certain age, the "don't move, the tree won't hurt you is not considered one of Doctor Who's finest hours, which is why I selected it out of the transcript.
Right. I mean, I mean, obviously, I've watched it, and I watched it a few times. And Nicola's a good friend, actually. Time Lash is one that I know better. Again, Paul Darrow doing his Richard III. that was funny. I was listening to one of your episodes the other day where, and was it Planet of Evil episode again? When you say, can you recommend something, and they recommended Time Lash because they come back to listen to it, watched it again, and something I call the Moonraker effect. You watch something for the first time and you dislike it so much that when you watch it again, you think, oh, this isn't so bad. Time. Paul Darrow actually, there's Richard III there. There's a quiz, a panel show from the late 70s here called Who Done It, fronted by John Pertwee, that I've got the DVDs of, and Paul Darrow appears in one of those as a detective, and John Pertwee fronts this. They act out a crime in front of an audience, and then the characters come out and sit and they're questioned by the celebrity panel. And they have to work out the clues and figure out who did it. And Paul Darrow is a detective in this thing, and he clearly is channeling Columbo, and he's just doing a Columbo impression throughout the whole thing. And I just think, you know, maybe that is one of his go-to things. For that, he went to Columbo. For Time Lash, he went to Richard III.
Peter Falk was one of my favorite actors growing up, because everything my parents watched in the late 70s seemed to have Peter Falk in it, right, including my parents' all-time favorite movie, Arthur Hiller's The In-Laws. So impression of Peter Falk will always go a long way with me. I think, and this is a spoiler for my Time Lash, I think that Paul Dano does a phenomenal job in Time Lash, because when you have a script that makes no sense like that, you need to do something to put it together. You need to do something to bring that sodden script to life. Mm. He is trying something. He's going for it. And he's playing a rather odious character who loves himself. I think he's very fun to watch, even if it's not objectively an Olivier-type performance. I think it works very well in the story that it's in. And as Paul Dano says in the DVD commentary for Time Lash, stop watching after I'm dead. It's boring. And he's right.
Well, and I've got to say, as a Scot, I take great offence to a story which, and I'm going to just step up the Scottish accent here, I take great offence to a story where it's depicted that the most horrible thing that can happen to you is you're thrown into a machine where you finish up at the shores of Loch Ness.
The gentle rolling hills of Scotland in the 13th century before air pollution and the spoliation of the environment. Time left me up, maybe. I would love to go to 13th century Scotland.
You'd like, hey mate, I got to tell you, 21st century Loch Ness is pretty damn good as well. I'm going to be up there next year. And
And now I realized I lost the opportunity to ask you if the Highlanders or Terror of the Zygons was your favorite of all time because of where they are located.
no, I mean, I could go on and on about the Highlanders, because I went to the Culloden battlefield earlier this year for the second time, just the day before the anniversary, and I could go on and on about that. And I loved your episode on that as well. And Terror of the Zygons, the Scottish setting for me is an extra buzz. And as a little boy, I'm sure Jamie, being the Doctor's companion, actually gave me an extra buzz as well. A Scottish lad being the Doctor's companion in his kilt, you know. And for me, that was fantastic. And I, you know, my Doctor is a second Doctor with Jamie and Zoe. That's my Doctor Who set that I remember as a kid that just hits a real sweet spot for me. Lovely stuff.
I got to interview Wendy Padbury at the L.I. Who convention about a year and a half ago. And you have to understand, I was in my late 40s at the time. I've spent 10,000 hours in open court arguing or defending or what have you. I was trembling like a leaf speaking to Wendy Padbury, who I've loved as a Doctor Who character since I was 12 years old. That was one of the more interesting experiences of my life. Why am I nervous? Why am I trembling?
The first convention I went to for a long, long time, so I think it's 2010, must have been after the East Space Trilogy came out on DVD, but I was a guest at a convention in Glasgow, and Wendy was there, and we're having dinner afterwards, and I sat opposite her, and I got to tell her that, you know, as a 6-7-year-old little boy, I now love the Dominators, and I told her, you know, it's burnt into my memory, the Quarks, and she, because when they were making it, I think pretty much they hated it. It was dreadful. The Quarks were dreadful, but I absolutely loved it, and I loved the Quarks, and I still would lap up anything with a Quark in it, you know. And she was like, wow, you know. Yeah, it was loved by the little 6 and 7 year olds like me who were watching it at the time.
It's funny you talk about your reaction to Doctor Who stories set in Scotland. For me, when Doctor Who comes to New York, which is where I was born and grew up and where I live now, I tend to be hypercritical of geographic mistakes, especially with The Angels Take Manhattan, which is just terrible geographic dyslexia, if that's the right word for it.
They do it in London. In the Bells of St. John, the route that Matt Smith takes to get to the Shard on the motorbike makes no sense whatsoever. It's, that's in London, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, and those are mistakes that I'd be less likely to pick up on. But the geographical errors they make, mistaking Battery Park for Tudor City, or the Statue of Liberty is the most continuously observed object on Earth. There is never a time when somebody is not looking at the Statue of Liberty. The Statue of Liberty faces Governor's Island, which in the 1930s was an active military base. There is no scenario where it can be a weeping angel that moves when unobserved. But that's my civic pride speaking up. I will say that the tour guide in The Chase, that is the most authentic Brooklyn accent you will ever hear, even though he was not a native New Yorker. So The Chase is absolutely 100. That is what New York is, that tour guide in The Chase. So I'll give props to that.
That New York thing, that's an attitude. It's a New York attitude, isn't it? Hey, I'm walking here. You know, it's a thing of, you know. And I get, as a former London police officer, I think, you know, that the depiction of the New York police officer is, hello, officer, could you tell me, buy a map? You know, it's just, that's just, yeah, the New York attitude. I'm sure it's very friendly, but, yeah, and I've met New York police officers as well who are not like that, but, yeah, it's interesting, the different cultures, yeah.
One of my closest friends is a retired New York City detective with the NYPD, but he is one of the few detectives on the force whose politics veered more towards the socialist than the other side of the spectrum, which in New York is not very common with the police force.
Yeah, I've had that thing. It's a police officer. I mean, Toby Haydock said this to me early on. You know, he's a friend of mine. Early on, and, you know, I was talking about various things, and he's surprisingly liberal. And I think because I was a police officer, people think I'd be right wing, and I'm not. I don't regard myself as left wing. I just think, what's the fair thing? What is the fair thing? What's the fair outlook? What's the thing? And, you know, there are various things that I'm set against, like capital punishment, absolutely not. And but I just, my views and things are just, you know, what's fair. Well, it's fair. And actually Brexit, some people I work with in the police brought out their leanings, and I ended some friendships on the back of that. And actually Trump again exposed some things. I'll leave it there. And like Toby said, he said, I find it surprisingly liberal. Yeah, I can. Police officers are not, you know, we're not just out there as like right wing supporters of the right wing or whatever, you know. We are, you know, I'm that guy. I'm that guy.
I have one friend who's a civil employee of the police who is a complete anti-vaxxer and election denier, and I have to just cut off certain conversations before they get started. I'm like, are you getting this because you've been working at the NYPD for 10 years, or did you come to the NYPD because you have these attitudes?
Mate, it's not how you look in a uniform, it's what you do when you're wearing it.
But I want to come back full circle and finish our guess the quotation game. We have one quote left. You have successfully nabbed the Ark in Space, and you have successfully gotten Mark of the Ronnie. Here is your final quote. Now for a short course in cytogenetics.
You're not quoting Full Circle at me, are you?
I am. Why do you ask?
I'm not sure.
I love that line, and I'm not quite sure why. I think because the second time that I saw Full Circle, I was in high school science. And we were just starting a unit on cytogenetics as that line came up. And they sailed past me the first time because I was too young.
I know Chris added all this stuff in, and a lot of I do remember at the read through. What was the line? It was sort of a carrier. I think it was a carrier types line. We were going through this, and I forget who had the line, but they said, they looked at me and said, is that right? And I said, I have no idea. But, oh, you swine. You nearly got, I haven't, Oh, I came so close. Does it? Oh. It's one story. It's probably the one Doctor Who story I watch less than any other.
Interesting.
No, it's just that, I mean, I'm very proud of it, and I watch Doctor Who to see something new, and it's like, I mean, I had a video recorder not long before the 1980 series, and I recorded it, so I have seen it a few times. Again, having written it, it's not something I sit down to watch to enjoy. But your show does the thing of, you know, that thing of, like, you listen to an episode, oh, I want to watch that. So today I've been watching episode one of The Planet of Evil,
ooh,
which I love, despite your view. I really, really love it. And of course, I really hate to say it, but bringing it full circle, it does bring us back to Target novels, because I explained in the interview, Planet of Evil was the serial that was broadcasting in 1975 when I discovered Target novels during a family weekend in Blackpool. And I went to the Doctor Who exhibition, and there were the Target novels. And it was the weekend that episode three was being broadcast. But I watched that first episode today, and I really, really loved it. And I hadn't seen it in years, so I was tutting during your episode. But
I desperately want to love Planet of Evil more than I do, because I was my father, growing up in New York in the 1950s, made sure that before I was 8 years old, I was able to, number one, name every member of the starting lineup of the 1960 New York Yankees baseball team. And I had to be able to name all of his favorite science fiction movies. So I watched Forbidden Planet several times before I was 10 years old. Wow. So the second that I saw the monster at the part one cliffhanger, I immediately recognized it as the Id Beast from Forbidden Planet.
Right.
It was one of the I immediately saw through the curtain, and I knew exactly what they were referencing.
Right. Yeah. It's the great thing with this fandom as well is stories. There are stories, and I was listening to something this week where you absolutely nailed it on the head, and I forget, it might even have been the Planet of Evil episode, I don't know, but you can like a story, you can love a story, you can dislike a story. If you can dislike a story, if someone else loves it, that doesn't make their view wrong at all. It's just, that's how you react. Just, I love the Dominators for my reasons. I know your feelings towards it are somewhat different. And we mentioned, we talked about Inferno, and I don't quite get the love for it. I watch it, it doesn't do that for me. I don't heavily dislike it, but it doesn't spark things off in me the way I know it does for a lot of other people. And there's things like in the modern series, I love the Rings of Akaten.
That is not a combination of words that I often hear spoken on that particular.
I do. I absolutely love it. I've got a little figure on the windowsill here of an usher from the Rings of Akaten, which is one of my favorites. And I don't know. I just do. And I know a lot of people have a very opposite opinion. But I do. And it's not wrong. And anyone who dislikes it, they're not wrong. It's just, you know, and I'm a storyteller, and I've had stories out there. People react differently to things. And so it's where you are in your head and your experiences in life or anything else, or however you are when you actually watch or listen to something or read something. And that's fine. And there are things I've watched and loved and then see them later, listen to them later, and don't have that same reaction. But I think I said to you in the interview before, what I find generally is things that I didn't like so much over time, my change seems to be more to the positive rather than to the negative. And I I really enjoy that. And I think it's, I'm a great believer in positivity, and I like the fact, you know, you can mellow to things and become more receptive.
After 40 years, it's difficult for me to hate anything. If I'm still watching Doctor Who 40 years later, why would I watch the show just to criticize the same story over and over again? This is archival television. It's over. It's done. It's been written, edited, filmed, put to bed, released, re-released. It doesn't do any good for me to say The Dominators is garbage and I'll never talk about it again. I try to look at every one of these stories now through at least a sympathetic eye, if not a positive one. And what's interesting is we have a lot of – now that most of current Doctor Who has been novelized by 1985, they're now revisiting the archives and they're going to start novelizing stories that were not considered stone-cold classics back in the day. So we're going to be getting now novelizations of stories like The Time Monster or The Gunfighters or The Censorites that nobody ever would have wanted to novelize when The Target Range first came out and was flying high and they were only adapting the classics. I spent years on Rick Arp's Doctor Who championing Frontier in Space, championing The Gunfighters, championing Ambassadors of Death. And these were all unpopular opinions, but I love these stories, and The Censorites especially. I have a lot to say about The Censorites, and I think it's terribly misunderstood, perhaps because some of the production flubs rather than the script. I think The Censorites has much to praise in it, and I think in some ways The Censorites are much better villains for season one than the Daleks, because the Daleks may be Nazi robots, which is fine, but the Censorites are philosophical aliens that are scared of the dark. And I think that puts Doctor Who on the map a lot more than anything else. As these books come up, I'll be talking about them, but these are stories that I love and most folks don't. But I enjoy being able to spread the word and talk about why I love Ambassadors of Death, even though that's a minority opinion. And at the same time, if I'm going to be talking about a show that I dislike, and we're coming to that with obviously Dominators recently, and there's a couple of Sylvester McCoy series that I really, really dislike, I want to have somebody on the show who likes those stories so I can have a give and take debate rather than just say,
I was talking. I was talking to Fraser throughout the and you actually throughout the Dominators episode because I do love it so much. The Gunfighters is an interesting one for me because I vacillate with that. From oh my god, that's awful. Hang on, and I go back and forward with it. And the Censorites, I don't. But the Censorites, I think, is a story that was written as a kind of, it's most like 1950s sci-fi story. It does, you know, especially that opening episode, I think, is very much like, it could be a Flash Gordon episode almost. But it isn't, the Gunfighters is one, yeah, I've been back and forth with that. But you think, there's something that was written back in the 60s that we're still talking about. You know, and I, you know, full circle, I, you know, it's been 43 years now, and still probably today someone has watched a bit of it, or this week someone has watched it, or next week will. And I did other stuff for TV, I did a play for television with Michael Sheard and Peter Capaldi's future wife, Elaine Collins,
ooh,
that I may be the only person who's got a copy of it, you know. And that's ephemeral. And I did radio plays and things that may never be seen and heard again. But that, because it's part of Doctor Who, I was 17 years old when I wrote it, and it will be watched by people probably long after I'm gone, because it's Doctor Who. It's quite something, and people will have opinions about it one way and the other. And it's quite a phenomenon. And I think I said to you in the interview, I still can't get my head around the fact you, there you are sitting in New York, and I regard this as such a British thing, that I grew up with. And the enthusiasm for Doctor Who, which is, I just think is so cool, especially classic Doctor Who. I'm amazed by it, and I love it that that you're over there and you kind of get it. All these people speaking British accents on alien planets and things, but you just love the adventure stories. It's fantastic.
I am deep into pre-production on the Gunfighters episode, which is less than 2 months away. And Jim Sangster is a lot of help there in terms of the musical aspect. But I grew up with a lot of these American Westerns, and there was an American show called The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, and it aired for most of the second half of the 1950s, and it ran for 229 episodes. That show has a ballad performed in every episode, and the lyrics change, but it's always the same melody to mirror the plot. So having the ballad in The Gunfighters, to me, is the most natural thing in the world, because I grew up learning about that show. You know, my father watched it when it came out when he was the same age that I was when I first discovered Doctor Who. You're very impressionable at 11 years old. So for me, the ballad is not only not an impediment to enjoying the story, but also the lyrics of the ballad are just absolutely hilarious, especially towards the second half of the story when Rex Tucker starts writing extra verses himself to mirror the plot. So I want to have a lot of positive things to say about The Gunfighters. And not only that, I enjoy that story more and more every time that I see it. I discover something else. So it's moved from a guilty pleasure to one of my all-time highly ranked Doctor Who classics.
I don't know what you think of it. I think the biggest influence on The Gunfighters is a movie, High Noon. And I say to people, if you to really appreciate The Gunfighters, watch High Noon before it. Because, again, there's a song throughout High Noon. And I think that's where the ballad comes from.
The man who shot Frank Miller dead.
Yeah, and I think there is that thing with Spooner scripts of they start out very comedic and turn out very tragic, which is really, really interesting. Really interesting. I vacillate, as I said, and how I think that works in The Gunfighters. But it works now, so the Romans and whatever. But I think if you watch High Noon before watching Gunfighters, the influence of I think they are clearly trying to do a High Noon, and that's where the ballad comes from. It's interesting. If you haven't listened to Toby Haydock's Who's Round with one of the guys who is in that, and I forget his name, but that's really interesting. The guy who describes them taking the horses out around, and they were riding the horses around Shepherd's Bush.
Right.
That's a really, really good episode to listen to, to go back on the Big Finish website. Can I just say that really awakening, there was one other thing I wanted to say that I didn't say earlier. I don't think with The Awakening, sorry to drag it back to that, but reading it, I don't think there's any other Target book that is so close to what is on the screen. And Eric Pringle clearly had the video alongside when he was writing it. And I think he takes full advantage of the fact he's got two episodes and he can add all this detail. And there are plenty of giveaways for that. When Tegan and Turlough see the soldier, they're in the village by the ford, and they split, and Tegan runs through the ford. That was scripted, that she runs up an alleyway, and that's how she's cut. There was no ford in the script, so that's clearly from that. And there are little points like, when in the novel, when Eric Pringle describes Jane Hamden's clothing, it's exactly what Polly James is wearing. And little points as well, like after the trooper's beheaded, the doctor says, "Braveheart, Tegan," and touches her arm, and Pringle specifies that he puts his hand on her arm. I haven't read all of the 80 Sargent novels, but I cannot believe there's another novel which so closely replicates what's on screen. Because the detail is pretty meticulous. And even the opening chapter, when Jane is turned up at the farm and she's looking around for Ben Wolsey, and she hears the horses. And despite the fact that's a bit odd because she doesn't seem to be aware of the war games at that point, when clearly she is. But
right.
But the thing with the horses was that scene as scripted was just she turns up and she looks around the farm, and it was a director who wanted to intercut this thing, this footage of the horses galloping. And Eric Pringle has incorporated that into the novel. Yeah, multiple examples. It's really interesting. I think it must be the single most accurate depiction of what is actually on screen versus what we see in the novel.
And it helps, as I mentioned earlier, that Eric Pringle has half the story to novelize and twice the space.
Yeah.
So he's able to add a lot of atmospheric description to individual scenes, and he's not adding new material or reinventing the wheel. He's just telling the story in twice the space. So the prose is a little more lush and dense than we're used to, especially from the early 80s when the books had shrunk to 110 pages. Now we're back to 144, and the authors are clearly enjoying having the extra room.
He still doesn't really explain what's going on.
No, he does not. He does not fabricate explanations.
Yeah, I mean, they again, for example, you know, there's a thing that the malice is purely evil. The malice is a living being. The malice is stone, but it has muscle and sinew. We still don't know what it's about, and we still don't get any explanation why the doctor says it was here to spearhead an invasion, when his first lines about it are that it's a superstition.
True.
And then he says, "The thing you call the malice." So is it he knows it's something else or not, or that? But just to sum it again, I'll sum it again. It's a lovely story. It's actually a lovely book to read. The prose, I think, is really good. I'm not so keen on things like descriptions of Sir George's skin on his cheeks twitching like there were beetles scuttling underneath. But overall, no, I think it's really good. You get a really strong depiction of where you are and the senses, and a real sense of where you are. And it's a good read. It's just to watch and to read, really nice. Lovely vibe, lovely tone, lovely setting. It's just, don't overanalyze it. Then I think the threads come unpicked. And being the guy who wrote about 40 generations and the Starliner, and you know, do you want to overanalyze that? I don't know. But so I may be, like I say, in that glass house throwing stones. But yeah.
Well, Andrew Smith, I cannot thank you enough for coming back and speaking to me so soon after our first conversation. Our next book to discuss is about a year down the road, so have a very good rest of the year, and I cannot wait to speak to you again.
It's been a pleasure, Jason. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Doctor Who, The Awakening, by Eric Pringle. Televised as The Awakening. Teleplay by Eric Sayward. From an outline by Eric Pringle. Screen credit to Eric Pringle. Televised in January 1984. Paperback release date June 13th, 1985. Target book number 95. Cover artist Andrew Skilleter. The Doctor has promised Tegan that they will visit her grandfather in the English village of Little Hodcombe in the year 1984, a precision of timing and location that the TARDIS has not always achieved. When the Type 40 machine comes to rest, the view on the scanner screen only serves to confirm Tegan's rather low expectations of the TARDIS's performance. The most sensible course of action would be to leave immediately. But despite Turlough's protests, the Doctor rushes out to take on a seemingly hopeless rescue mission. With apologies to Andrew Smith, who's become a dear friend over these past few months, I still love The Awakening. It was one of my first TV stories, for one thing. But then again, so were Ark of Infinity and Warriors of the Deep, you say? To which I respond, my ongoing love for The Awakening is not mere nostalgia. As a blend of paganism and satanic forces, menacing a church in the pastoral British countryside, the story reflects influences such as The Wicker Man or Doctor Who's own The Demons, full of iconic imagery. Now, I saw Awakening a few weeks before I first encountered The Demons, and 20 years before I first saw Wicker Man, but I've come to find out that I love the source material. Plus, at just 2 parts in length, I find the pacing pretty taut, and the production is bolstered by strong guest performances, not all of which Andrew and I got a chance to discuss. As we've been talking about in recent weeks on this podcast, much of the target output from the mid-1980s bears little resemblance to the televised story being adapted. John Lucarotti made wholesale changes to Marco Polo in last week's episode 94, and will make even more to The Massacre when we get there in several more months, making his novelizations almost completely different and separate entities from their TV versions. Donald Cotton did much the same with his versions of the Romans, the Mythmakers, and the Gunfighters, the first book of which is due to come up on this show in about 2 weeks, although the 60th anniversary month of November 2023 may push that back a little. I'll let you know. But that is what's yet to come. You won't find alternate worlds out of Eric Pringle. His take on The Awakening is a straight-up adaptation of the shooting scripts. Every line of dialogue is ported over from the TV. On paper, that approach could be deadening, especially given what creativity Pringle's fellow target authors have been getting up to at around the same time. But for 2 reasons, Pringle's novelization still stands out. For one, this is a 136-page book, which in 1985 is becoming the standard length for Target, after a few years of books between just 100 and 120 pages. But The Awakening is an adaptation of a 2-part story, so to paraphrase what I said earlier in the program, Eric Pringle gets to do half the story in twice the space. I may have said earlier that this is the only novelization of a classic series 2-parter to not add or change things. That may be wrong. We'll circle back around to that when we get to The Ultimate Foe, or as you purists rather unimaginatively call it, The Trial of a Time Lord, parts 13 and 14. But Terence Dudley, who will in several months on this show adapt his own brace of 2-part adventures for the Target line, Black Orchid and the King's Demons, will cram his novelizations with extra scenes, add new storylines, a completely different ending in the case of King's Demons, and will save the lives of one dead TV character in each story. Pringle doesn't do any of that. He adds not a scene, hardly even another word to the TV scripts. So that means that Pringle's book has plenty of time to breathe. Scene settings and descriptions can go on for twice as long as normal. Quick cut scenes that feature just 20 to 30 words of dialogue on air can last for 2 to 3 pages in print. It takes about 31 pages of book to get to minute 7 of the TV story, for example. Pringle's treatment of the part 1 cliffhanger is ratcheted with tension and manages to improve on what for me is a pretty superlative TV version. "Look out!" Jane yelled, too late, for smoke erupted from the hole, as if the noise had assumed visible form. It poured over the Doctor like a waterfall, and he was obscured instantly. The noise roared and the smoke billowed, and inside it there were exploding noises, as if the wall was disintegrating. The Doctor was inside it too. He had disappeared. "Doctor!" Jane screamed and screamed. Page 80. The second interesting point about the Awakening novelization is this. Eric Pringle, as far as we can tell, did not write the Awakening. Let's quote from another friend of mine, Shannon Patrick Sullivan, of the Brief History of Time Travel website. I've met Shannon when he visited New York City back in the year 2000. Great guy. Great website, too. Here's what Shannon says. Although Pringle worked closely with Sayward in completing The Awakening, the script editor concluded that the finished drafts were too long, and he carried out extensive rewrites to address the problem. He also wanted to diminish the supernatural aspects of the narrative, then sought to strengthen the science fiction elements. To this end, Sayward provided the Malice with a backstory connected to the Terraleptals, the aliens he had created for 1982's The Visitation. He had also hoped to lay the groundwork for their return appearance. Pringle was unhappy with Sayward's rewrites, which he believed made the story confusing and rushed. The Awakening would become his only contribution to Doctor Who. Thanks to Shannon Patrick Sullivan for writing that. And I don't know about you, but I have a hard time disliking any Doctor Who story that quotes from the 1938 The Adventures of Robin Hood film. See if you can spot the line in the following audio clip.
Doctor! Wait. Will said he saw the Malice in 1643 in the church.
That's right.
Then it's been there for hundreds of years.
Well, long before the Civil War started.
Then why has it been dormant for so long?
Requires a massive force of psychic energy to activate it. When the Civil War came to Little Hotcombe, it created precisely that.
And Sir George is trying to recreate the same event.
Yes, in every detail. Tegan's grandfather must have told him everything he discovered. He knows it's the only way for the Malice to be fully activated.
Doctor, I've had a terrible thought. The last battle in the War Games has to be for real.
Precisely. The slaughter will be dreadful.
You must stop him.
Yes, I know.
History is littered with loons like you. Fortunately, most of them end up safely locked away.
Insight is often mistaken for madness, my dear.
Well, I didn't realize that the Malice was so evil.
Don't worry, Wolsey. It will serve us.
It will use you.
Tegan's right. You are energizing a force so irresistibly destructive that nothing on Earth can control it. You must stop the War Game.
Stop it? Are you mad? You speak treason.
Fluently. Stop the games.
Oh, boy. A few different things that I love about that audio clip. First, Peter Davison's performance, especially against Polly James, who was the perfect foil. You can see the frustration and the thinly veiled agitation as Polly James keeps interrupting the Doctor's train of thought and keeps stopping them as they're making a very important walk down a long hallway to keep making banal observations such as, "We must stop them." This is Davison in Season 3, finally playing the Doctor the way that he wants to play the role. We talked about this back in the Frontios episode. Polly James is terrific, though, as a pseudo-companion. And we also heard in that clip Glenn Houston, who was so good in The Hand of Fear, playing the nuclear power plant director. And we also hear from Dennis Lill, who had played Dr. Fendelman in Image of the Fendal. Fendal, not my favorite Tom Baker-era story, and Dennis Lill's performance is perhaps hampered somewhat in that by the unusual accent that he is adapting for the role. The Awakening, though, is unfiltered Dennis Lill. I think he gives an absolutely great performance here, one of the highlights of the episode. So really, just a terrific guest cast all around in The Awakening. Polly James, Dennis Lill, Glenn Houston. And you heard a little bit of them in the clip that just played. There are a few other touches in the story that feel like pure Eric Sayward to me. Sergeant Willow menacing Tegan sexually, and the Malice's psychic projection within the TARDIS in Part 2 literally puking itself to death. One might have hoped that the novelization would have been a forum for Pringle to novelize his own original four-part outline and throw out everything that Sayward changed or added, as John Lucarotti will later do when he writes The Massacre. Maybe there were good reasons for Pringle not doing that, and instead he faithfully adapts those same scripts that he found to be, quote, confusing and rushed. The biggest remaining trace of his original proposal is the repeated comparison of the Malice to a poltergeist, with Poltergeist having been one of the story's working titles, but the Tobe Hooper/Steven Spielberg movie of 1982 probably made that impractical to use for a Doctor Who episode. There are some indications that Pringle didn't understand the Doctor Who format all that well. In the novelization, he has the Doctor fear that two soldiers trying to batter down the TARDIS doors with chunks of masonry might actually succeed. And Turlough, the quote-unquote untrustworthy companion, doesn't have all that much to do on TV, apart from comments sarcastically on the unfolding action once in a while. He's a bit flat in print, with Pringle not managing to add any of the delicious oiliness that Mark Strickson brought to the role. I invite you to look back to our recent discussion on Frontios, episode 91, with Cy Hart, for a longer appreciation of Mark Strickson. That said, Pringle captures the Doctor and Tegan particularly well. Quote, "It was time for the Doctor to act. He knew the signs, and was only too well aware of Tegan's talent for jumping to conclusions and diving in at the deep end of things." Pringle also puts his finger on the Doctor's special magnetism. Quote, "He was a strange man, Jane thought, with a remarkable authority. She realized that she trusted his judgment implicitly, and with only a passing hesitation at why she should put her life in the hands of a complete stranger, she followed him out of hiding." Guest characters like Colonel Woolsey, Glenn Houston, and especially the story's human bad guy, Sir George, Dennis Lill, benefit well from the extra space provided by the book. Hutchinson's descent from village squire into the Malice's mad zombie pet, and Woolsey's parallel progression from Hutchinson's henchman, try saying that five times fast, Hutchinson's henchman, Hutchinson's henchman, Hutchinson's henchman, well, not that hard, I guess, to the Doctor's vital ally, are described at length, adding extra layers onto the already solid work given by the two performers. I do wish that Sir George had been given more backstory in the book. We get faint hints that he was an honorable man before he discovered the Malice, although we also learn on page 138 that when Will Chandler looks at him, he sees the 17th century equivalent. But again, Pringle is not here to add new story beats, so that kind of backstory had to be reserved for the hundreds of Doctor Who fans writing Sir George fanfic on alt Doctor Who creative in the early 90s. There are other times, of course, where Pringle doesn't seem to know what to do with the extra space he's been given for the book. Late in part one, he gets bored enough to start personifying a chair, which, quote, "stood like a sentinel in the middle of the rough, boarded floor." Moments like that are rare, thankfully. Much better is when Will Chandler, the 17th century boy inexplicably caught up in the story's 20th century conflict, takes charge during the climax. Quote, "And Will, freed from the anchorage of his fear, shot out of the group like an arrow released from a bow and scuttled into the smoke billowing around the Malice and Sir George." One little grace note. Almost every sergeant in the history of the Target Run was described with the adjective burly. Now the one sergeant in this story, Joseph Willow, is not given that description, although Pringle says of him rather wonderfully that he, quote, "had the rasping, ill-tempered voice of a natural bully." But there is a colonel, Ben Woolsey, Glenn Houston's character, who is described as burly not once, not twice, but how gratifying to do it three times over. Eric Pringle may not have been an expert on Doctor Who, but he certainly knows which words belong exclusively to the novelizations. Next time on Doctor Who Literature, we leave season 21 behind for a very long time, come to find out, and we dip back once again into Doctor Who's back catalog. For the second time recently, we are revisiting the John Pertwee era. It is a classic TV episode, and it is, for me, a very influential and a profoundly important novelization. Who else to discuss with me but producer of this show, Jim Sangster. Jim has a lot, and I mean a lot, to tell us about The Mind of Evil, and other events going on in the world of Doctor Who that Jim may be involved with, you won't want to miss this one, as Jim and I discuss Doctor Who, The Mind of Evil, next week. Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Andrew Smith. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, on Blue Sky and Twitter and Mastodon.social. Also on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.